To get ahead of the markets, stay ahead of the trends. Welcome to Ahead of the Trend, where what meets when, with financial experts Ike Iosef and Jim Poplava.
Welcome, everyone, to this month's Ahead of the Trends. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Ike Iosef. And this month, we have, as a guest, a good friend of mine and also someone who has made rather controversial calls in the past, which for some reasons, they have all come true. I'm talking about no other than Mr. Glenn Neely, who is the president of Elliott Wave Institute, that was founded back in 1983. Glenn is the author of a highly successful book, Mastering Elliott Wave, and he has come up with his own way to interpret Elliott Wave Theory. In July of 2001, I was interviewing Glenn, and he told me on the air that he was expecting a rather devastating decline in September due to a catastrophic event. And of course, anyone who listened to us in July of 2001 thought that Glenn was out of his mind. And then in September, we got September 11th. In 2002, in April, as a matter of fact, again, I was interviewing Glenn, and he told me that over the next 6 to 8 weeks, he was expecting the fastest and most severe decline we had seen in the S&P in years. And in fact, over the next 8 weeks, the S&P lost 30% of its value. And then again, in December of 2003, Glenn told me that he was expecting a parabolic rise in the S&P that will pretty much cap the market. And that is exactly what happened between December of 2003 and early January of 2004. So my good friend Glenn has had his share of controversial calls, which have been, for one reason or another, correct. Glenn, hi. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi. Doing good.
Would you like to tell our listeners your way of interpreting Elliott Wave before we get into the details?
Well, my approach basically doesn't wipe out any of the old wave theory. It just adds a lot of additional rules and criteria and requirements to the theory, so it makes it more scientific, more regimented, and it eliminates almost all of the subjectivity and opinions that are typically associated with wave theory, because in the regular Elliott Wave world, you might say, if you ask 3 or 4 or 5 different analysts what they think the market's doing, the current wave structure and so forth, they usually all have different opinions. And obviously that's a big problem. If a theory is supposed to be based on some universal laws, then you can't have everyone having different opinions. Otherwise, it really is not a theory or a scientific approach. It's just someone's opinion. So I've tried to design additional rules to the original wave theory so that it can help to eliminate all these subjective opinions and arrive at one concrete scenario or arrive at no scenario. Either it's one or the other. And for that reason, through the application of these additional approaches and techniques, I've been able to keep a very consistent perspective on the stock market for the last 20 years. And I rarely ever change what I think the market's going to do over, you know, intermediate to longer periods of time. And today's show is obviously about just updating my long-term perspective, which will be similar to what I've been saying for a long time with just some slight adjustments.
In the past 3 years that we've been doing our interviews, you have made 3 calls that at the time were very controversial, yet all 3 predictions came true. In July of 2001, you predicted that going into September, we were going to have a catastrophic event. Those were your exact words. And of course, we got September 11th.
Right.
Then in April of 2002, you said that over the next 6 to 8 weeks, you were expecting the fastest and most severe decline the S&P had seen in years. And over the next 8 weeks, we saw a 30% decline in the S&P. And then again, in December of 2003, you told us that you were expecting a parabolic move in the S&P, which would cap the rally that we had seen from March of 2003, which is exactly what happened.
Right. I'm going to be hard-pressed to beat that record, huh?
I think we should stop right here because it's all downhill from this point on.
I quit.
Glenn, give us a little bit of an overview with regards to the revision that you made in our previous 2 interviews, and then we'll take it from there.
Well, for the last 16 years, since 1988, I had made a forecast back in 1988 in an actual written article in Cycles magazine that I thought that the crash low of 1987, this was just maybe 6 to 8, 9 months after the crash low had occurred, had predicted that the crash low of 1987 would never be broken for the rest of my life and really for the next 100 years or so. and that the Dow had mapped out what I thought would happen, and that it would exceed somewhere in the 8,000 to 10,000 range in the next 10 to 15 years, which it actually achieved, well, within that time frame. And then I also predicted it would reach about 100,000 by the middle part of this century. And that part of the forecast is obviously still to be seen. But on the show, I had made, in the second part of the interview, I had made a revision to my long-term count, just a structural revision, not a real forecast revision. In other words, I still think we're going to get to 100,000. It may even be higher. I still think that can happen around the mid part of the century. But just the way in which I counted the structure from 1949 all the way to present had slightly changed. So that was the first time I had actually made a change to my count in 16 years. So that's the reason why we had decided to do the second part of the series. If I can, I'd like to cover some of the reasons, because I'd like to give the listeners a foundation on why I'd originally made that forecast back in 1988, what the structural reasons were, what the fundamental reasons were, and then take that to the next step here with what I think is going to happen over the next 10 to 15 years, and how in the world the Dow is going to go from, say, 10,000 up to 100,000 over the next 20, 30, 40 years. So if I can do that, I'd just like to review a little bit my forecast in 1988 to justify how we were going to have such an incredible boom in the stock market. Was that said, number one, that the seeds were being sown at the time for an international boom of unprecedented proportions. And this, of course, again, was 1988 when things were not doing very well. The economy was slowing down. We'd had the big crash in 87. A lot of people were very fearful of the future. The gloom and doom was, you know, palpable at the time. I also said in the article that over the next few decades that the majority of the third world countries would become industrialized, which would bring dramatic improvements in the standard of living of all citizens, which is one reason why the stock market would continue to rally. And then the final thing I said was that international competition would create a keep-up-with-the-Joneses mentality, forcing many communist countries such as Russia to move toward a more productive capitalistic system. And as you know, the article was written 1 or 2 years before the Berlin Wall fell, and of course a lot of communist countries have now fallen and are starting to become more free enterprise-oriented. And I think the current war in Iraq and Middle East problems that we've been having is all part of this continuing fight and transition from an old world, a dictatorship kind of economic structure to a more free enterprise-based democratic kind of society on a global scale. So these changes are what's creating this boom that should continue for at least another 50 years. So, you know, with that said, what I was hoping to go through today is what are the reasons that it's going to continue? What are the new reasons? What are the new perspectives? And how are things going to change over the next 10, 20, 30 years?
Glenn, let's talk about your outlook, your economic, social, and political outlook. And let's talk about, for example, you believe now that in the year 2000, that we began the fourth wave. Explain the fourth wave correction and its implications for the economy and politics.
Okay, well, a fourth wave, if it's a large fourth wave pattern, will create a certain kind of psychological environment. This is part of wave theory, but it's also part of some things that I've advanced in wave theory. It has to do with the type of development that occurs psychologically the larger the pattern is. And in a fourth wave pattern, that would be the period where society starts to become much more politically oriented, much more concerned about consolidating its power, whatever that is, on a national, international basis, about extending its influence and control as far out as possible, the possible expansion of empires or kingdoms or countries. And so a lot of the forecasts that I'm going to be making today are based on the idea that we started this fourth wave and what fourth waves are psychologically and what that is going to suggest the U.S. is going to be doing over the next 10, 15, 20 years as part of this new psychological environment that we began in 2000 for the first time in our lifetime.
You expect that during this period of time that the U.S. will turn more imperialistic,
yeah,
in terms of maybe annexing other countries?
Right. You know, again, fourth wave psychology has to do with, how about if I do this? If I give you an overview step by step of how things evolve from one wave to the next, and then you can see how it gets us to where we currently are. When you're in large first wave patterns, that's when you're going to be more associated with survival, with wars and panics, invasions, pestilence, crashes, depressions, recessions, and things like that. As you move into second wave patterns on a large scale, that's when you become more interested in things like safety, building shelters and protecting assets. As you go into large third waves, that's when you become much more social, or the society becomes more social. Standard livings increase, material abundance increases, there's much more social interaction, cooperation, and building of organizations and things like that. So the U.S. has already been going through that for quite a long time, and now that the third wave has completed at the high in 2000, we're going to have this shift in psychology and behavior, because a lot of the things that need to be set up have already been set up to set the stage for us to begin expanding on a more global basis, our power and our influence and our money and so forth. So that's what this fourth wave will be mostly about, is trying to gain more prominence around the world, controlling more things, influencing more things. And you can see this has already, you know, been happening for quite some time, but it's going to become more pronounced over the next, I think, 10 to 20 years. So what I'm looking for as a result of all this is a shift away from our growth environment that we've been in for so long and more into a protectionist, consolidation of power kind of environment. And as a result, this would be typical of nations when they become more imperialistic and try to start either taking over, annexing other countries, other societies, and so forth. So I do think there's a strong probability that sometime in the next 10 to 20 years that the U.S. could annex some of our close territories, such as Mexico, possibly.
How about Canada?
I'm not so sure about Canada. It's a little bit harder guess right now, and it's a country that's in much better shape than Mexico, economically speaking. So that's a little harder guess on that. But I could see eventually maybe 30, 40, 50 years from now, this entire region, just like what happened in Europe when they centralized with the euro and became more of a one economic power because of it, I could see that eventually happening with Canada also. So that would be probably later more than earlier, but I think it's a definite possibility.
You also see that in this period of time that perhaps that we'll do away with the present income tax system and go more towards a consumption tax?
Yeah, the long-term forecast that I made back in 1988 and talking about the fall of communism and massive worldwide boom in productivity and so forth was mostly based on the fact that all human progress is founded on increasing efficiency. And so it was very easy just to look over the political and economic landscape and figure out what is the most inefficient system on earth at that time. And communism, I think, ranked at that time as the most inefficient way to run a society. So it was a pretty easy guess that if we were going to get this great economic boom, which wave theory suggested we would, that for that to happen, the most inefficient systems had to come to an end. And that's how it came about predicting that. So now we're in a new phase where those governments are already either crashing down or have already changed. So what's the next most, you might say, insidious, inefficient part of the U.S. system, at least? And I think that has a lot to do with our tax structure, our tax system. It's incredibly inefficient, extremely burdensome, expensive. There's a lot of waste. There's a lot of, you know, corruption and so forth, and nobody understands it. It keeps getting more complicated. So it's a big problem. And so if we're going to continue to boom, which wave theory, again, continues to say we're about, say, 10 to 15 years away from the next huge economic boom in the stock market, if that's going to happen, then sometime during the next 10 to 20 years, we're going to have to lay the foundation to get rid of a lot of this waste. Now, because trends usually start, new trends usually start toward the end of an old trend, it may take until 2010, 2015 before we see even the beginning talk and serious discussion of changing the current tax system. But it's going to have to eventually be changed or eliminated for us to get, I think, to the next level of economic progress. So I do see the IRS either changing or getting eliminated, and that consumption tax is the way the founding fathers originally wanted the tax system to work, and that's far more efficient and far more fair. So there's a pretty high probability that we're going to be heading toward that over the next 10, 20, maybe 30 years.
In regards to getting rid of the IRS tax system, what about the present money system and the Federal Reserve?
Well, this is a little bit more of a tough call. Because of technology, money has become really a virtual concept instead of a physical concept. I think there's inherent risk with that. So, it's a little more tough call, but I think at least on a fairness basis that it is unfair that our government is able to spend money that they haven't collected in taxes just by having money basically printed and lent to them without the okay of the U.S. citizenry. So I think over time, there's a high probability as the U.S. citizen or the U.S. population becomes more politically active over the next 5, 10, 15 years, they're going to be aware of these things in our system that allow the government to do things they shouldn't be able to do, get money they shouldn't be able to get, or spend money they shouldn't be able to spend. So a lot of the inefficiencies and unfair aspects of our system will be washed out because of increased focus on the political system and the fact that it's currently starting to break down in many ways, which I'll go into shortly and some of the reasons why that's taking place. So there's a decent chance, I'm not sure if it'll be a gold standard or not, but just there's a decent chance that the way money is controlled and the way it moves around may change, and that could put an end to the Federal Reserve over a period of time, but I'm sure that's going to be 20, 30, 40 years away from now.
Getting to your imperial ambitions of the United States, one of the things that I say, and I don't know how you would account for this, but you believe that a lot of the international disputes will be settled through diplomacy versus war.
Right.
But we have two developments right now in China. The top consul of the new premier of China, the three new members of his consul are now all military, the head of the rocket force, the navy, the army. China is spending a lot more money on armaments and particularly nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
And we have the same thing going on in Russia with the consolidation of power by Putin and then also his ambitions to rebuild the Russian military. Does these conflicts or these imperialistic ambitions, as you see in the U.S., how would that be viewed, for example, like a China or a Russia?
That's hard to say. I'm not real familiar with, the psychological makeup of those societies, so that would be a really tough call for me. Keep in mind, though, that most of these predictions that I'm making here are not going to be happening right away. It's going to mostly start to evolve toward the end of, easily at the end of this decade, but more like around 2015, because the current correction that we're in is going to last for at least another 5 to 10 years, and things usually don't get really bad until the end of a correction, which is one reason why the big breakdown that we saw from 2000 to 2002 in the stock market, despite the size of it and the huge percentage decline that we saw, that we really didn't see the repercussions of that in our economy and haven't really to any great extent. And the reason for that is because that was just the first phase, sort of the shot across the bow of this large correction, and things really won't get bad probably until around 2015. And it's at that time that a lot of these predictions will probably start coming to pass and be much more obvious. So the current circumstances right now will have very little bearing on how things will probably evolve over the next 5 to 10 years. Mention about the royal class and the royal society and the imperialistic ambitions, those are going to be progressing possibly against other countries fighting against us on that. But most likely, if it's localized, like Mexico, Canada, and territories, island territories around the U.S., I can't see how that would be of any huge threat to these foreign countries, and how would they stop it anyway. It'd be more of an economic agreement, not necessarily where we're not taking over Canada or taking over Mexico by force. It'd be mostly an agreement to do so because it would be in the best interest of everyone. So that's how I see those things happening. I don't really know if we're going to be able to do things across the ocean like we're fighting the war in Iraq, but I don't think we're going to try to take over that country. That would be much more difficult and really cause a lot of problems with our allies and our enemies around the world, I'm sure.
What about this issue that you bring up that we will evolve eventually, and this goes with Imperium, which is a emergence of a high society or a royal class within the U.S. Certainly we're seeing wealth gravitate more towards the top,
right,
with a more educated elite that you're seeing that. Does this go along with that trend?
Well, yeah, partly. As a country becomes wealthier, as the standard of living increases, there tends to be higher expectations on everyone. And so the probabilities are that as the wealth of the U.S. continues to increase due to increased efficiencies and technology, that the expectations of individuals will continue to increase, and along with those expectations will be changes in, you know, appearance, having a much more, quote, presentable appearance, more high society kind of appearance. So there's a pretty strong chance beginning 2010, 2015, 2020 in there that there could be a dramatic shift in the way that Americans dress, the standards that are kept, and the things that are expected of people. Obviously, the dress standards in the U.S. are pretty low right now. You know, you can go to work in blue jeans and so forth. So those are the kind of things that I see changing because of increasing economic prosperity, which will increase the expectations of everyone because everyone can afford it.
What about some of the issues that we face right now, which is burgeoning trade deficit, that 6% of GDP, budget deficits, and the fact that foreigners now own close to 50% of our treasury debt? Do you see any fallout during this down wave that you're talking about this next 10 years as a result of that?
Yeah, definitely. I think the hugest risk our economy faces right now, which probably, again, won't surface until around 2015, give or take a few years, will be the busting of the real estate bubble that's been going on for quite a while and may take a long time to finally settle down. As the baby boomers pass their peak buying period, which according to all the information I have is around the year 2006, once that period has been passed, then the demand for real estate will continually decline for probably at least 20 years, in other words, a whole generation, so maybe even 25 years. That could cause huge problems with banks. If people, as the economy slows down, people lose their jobs, they can't pay their mortgages. So all these mortgages that have been given out at zero down, 1%, 5% down, are going to cause huge problems for banks. So I see our banking system as probably one of the riskiest aspects of our economic system going over the next 10 to 15 years. And this could be what forces some of those changes I mentioned earlier with the Federal Reserve and with our money system. In other words, people may get sick and tired of this boom-bust cycle that they've experienced many times in the last, say, 100 years, and it may force a rethinking of that whole system. So that could be what is the impetus behind the changes that I mentioned earlier.
Another issue that you see that I'd love to see transpire is a reformation of our whole education system. Speak about that.
Well, as our economy gets more complex, and because of technology and the Internet, it's allowing people to go to school at home on their computer. It's bringing out the obvious facts, you know, as we move out of an industrial era in society, that you're not trying to create automatons who can go to work, you know, 8 to 5 and do the exact same thing and train them to do just one specific kind of job. That creativity and intelligence and being able to see beyond the ordinary are the things that are going to be most rewarded in the future. And so our school system, which was really designed to take care of an industrial society, is obviously going to have to change as part of that process. So I see very strong chance in the next 5 to 10 years, maybe 15, that there'd be a radical restructuring of our government school system. Obviously, the problems we're already having are going to be an impetus to make that happen, on top of the fact that we really need it for other reasons. That private colleges and private schools that are already starting to pop up more frequently, but I would see that the government might want to begin easing out of the schooling system, and one way to do that would be to get rid of the later grades, like 9 through 12, and let kids start to specialize more. Because of our complex society, they're not going to be able to just teach the same things to all the kids. Probably all the way through 12th grade, they'll have to start specializing more as they get, you know, into their teens. So there's a pretty strong chance that we'll start getting specialized schools on the 9th through 12th grade levels, and that the government will get out of the schooling business eventually completely, but it'll phase out over time. And I think the lower grades will probably remain with the government, and the higher grades will start to fade into private hands.
Well, one trend that we're starting to see a lot more of is a lot of the upper-end universities now are allowing, for example, master's programs and PhDs that you can get through the Internet,
right,
but maybe only very little class time once or twice a year.
Yeah, that's you know, just a touch on, or just the beginning of what could be massive changes in our schooling system. Obviously, you could get to the point where you wouldn't even need physical locations to have school. You could do everything virtually, and that would be quite a development and create incredible savings and money and buildings and all that stuff. So that could be, again, part of the foundation as the government saves more and more money on its current systems, that it will allow the economy to be more efficient, taxes to be lower, and so forth.
But, Glenn, can you really have an effective educational system if it's all done in a virtual environment? I really don't believe so.
I can't answer that right now. And I think, yeah, if it's on a computer screen, probably not. But, you know, with the technologies that are probably coming down the road, I was talking about this maybe about 10 years ago. I foresee the time in the next 5 or 10 years as plasma screens and that kind of technology gets really cheap, that you could have an entire wall in a room with nothing but a virtual window into some other location, and it could be designed so that everyone feels like they're in the same place, but nobody's in the same place at all. So I think that's technology that would then allow you to feel like you're in a class environment, but you're actually not.
What about some of the radical government changes that you see? If we become more imperialistic, how does that go with, for example, dissolution of the centralized control of government in Washington?
Well, that's more on a U.S. basis internally among its citizens because of dissatisfaction with lack of representation, not necessarily the ambitions of the country as a whole, which could be independent of us becoming more efficient as a governmental system. So I see that most people are not aware of this, but I think it's one of the big problems with our current government is that the U.S. Constitution sets an upper limit on the number of people that a representative in the House can speak for, and that number is 30,000 people. Most people are unaware of this, but if you take current U.S. population estimates, it may be more than 300 million, but just to make the math easy, let's say it's 300 million. If you divide that by 30,000, you get 10,000, and that technically is supposed to be the number of representatives in the House of Representatives. Obviously, you can't have 10,000 people in one building for a meeting, so that would be, I guess, almost impossible, right? So for that reason, a long time ago, the Congress started putting limits on how many representatives there could be because there was only so much room in the House of Representatives, and it's currently, believe it or not, capped at 435 people. So now we have a situation where 435 people represent what should really be represented by 10,000 people, so about 2,000% greater number of people should be there that aren't. And that's one of the reasons why we're having all the problems that we're having with our government, with things like campaign finance laws, with lobbyists and so forth. If you imagine if we had really 10,000 representatives, we could have one that would be close to our own home, we could speak to easily, but now with only 435, it's very difficult for the average person to ever get to speak to any of these people. The lobbyists are the ones that mostly get in to talk to them because they're the ones with the money. It centralizes the whole government into one place, so the lobbyists know where to go, the people with money know where to go, the corporations know where to go, and there's so few people that they can try to manipulate and bribe that it allows for effective use of that process. But if you had 10,000 people, how good is it going to be to bribe one or two or three or four or five of them? You're not going to have any impact at all. So by increasing the representation to where it really should be, we would eliminate a huge host of problems that currently plague Washington, and that would be, again, one part of the campaign finance laws could be relaxed because, you know, there would be virtually no advantage in trying to bribe. I mean, who's going to bribe 10,000 people? It takes too much money, right? And with representatives, instead of being centrally located in Washington, they could be more in their own districts, not have to travel to Washington, and everybody could vote virtually and electronically. This would allow for incredible increases in efficiency, number one, much better representation on the local level. So the whole process would be much more efficient. It would be unbribable, pretty much, to any great extent. Redistricting would be a non-issue because you would be districting such small portions at a time. And you wouldn't have to pay these people so much money because they wouldn't have to have multiple homes, one in Washington, one, you know, elsewhere, somewhere else. It would also start to bring the power away from Washington and the central government and bring it more back to on a local level. So that would cause a decentralization of our government power as within the country, but it wouldn't necessarily change the power of the country as a whole. Because of the decentralization, it would also make terrorist attacks on Congress and political entities virtually useless because there would be so many people all spread around the country that it wouldn't make it a viable alternative. But if they had actually hit the House of Representatives and the Senate in 9/11, it would have been a disaster because everybody was centralized in one location. So this would avoid that problem. So from a safety standpoint, it's also a good idea. But mostly the reason I think it's going to happen is because it's going to be more efficient. It will allow for better representation of the people. Things will get done the way they want them to get done instead of all the centralization of power the way it is now and the corruption that's allowed.
Glenn, a lot of people that subscribe to Elliott Wave Theory see a Great Depression and deflation. What are your views in that regard?
That's, of course, been their view for most of them for at least 16 years. I've been saying for that same amount of time that obviously I think they're wrong. I think their wave counts are wrong, which is what's creating their improper perspective. I don't see structurally any reason to believe that that's going to happen at all. I think we're back in a similar situation now that I was 16 years ago, because back in 1988 when I first said that I thought the crash low of 87 would never be broken for the rest of my life, people thought I was really out of my mind. I mean, they just thought I was a lunatic. It's not so bad now, but a few months ago, I'm saying, you know, with the current environment on Ike's show just some time back, I mentioned that I thought the 2002 low would be the bottom of this bear market and that it probably won't be broken for the rest of my life. Again, there's opposition to that, but not to the extreme level that occurred back in 1987. And the reason for that, you know, in the very early stages of a smaller correction within the third wave that started from 1982 all the way up to 2000. So the psychological environment was a lot different than it is now, and we're not going to get a very negative psychological environment in the U.S. or economic circumstances for probably 5 to 10 years. So it's going to be much more hard to believe when I continue to say this maybe for five to 10 years. But for right now, it's the opposition to this isn't so great, but most people do believe, or at least wave theory people, believe that we've topped out, that we're on the verge of another huge decline in the stock market, and that things are going to get incredibly worse. But anytime something's comfortably easy to believe, and especially if the majority says, you know, thinks it's possible, then it virtually never takes place, because the markets always tend to go in the opposite direction of what the majority believes. So that would be my primary argument against that, but mostly the way that I do wave structure just tells me that we started a correction at the high in 2000. We've seen the bottom of that correction, which would be wave A on a pretty large scale here. We're going to go sideways between the 2000 high and the 2002 low for about 5 to 10 more years. And then once that's over, then I think we'll begin what should be the biggest, fastest bull market of all time.
What about deflation versus inflation? I mean, everywhere I go, I don't care if it's food, you know, going to the gas station, seeing my dentist, a visit to the doctor, textbooks, everything that I look at is going up. And the stuff that I don't need, DVD players are going down.
Things are easily mass-produced, you know, are generally going down in cost. But this is where I've been told to tread very lightly. Generally speaking, I don't see any huge problems with inflation for at least the next 4 to 5 years. After that, say around the year 2010 to 2015, there's a pretty decent chance that we'll see significant increase in inflation pick up for about 5 to 10 years after that. So maybe moving in 2030, 2040, which could account to a great extent for the boom that I'm looking for in the stock market. So a lot of the advance in the stock market could be strictly just based on inflation of the currency and inflation of the numbers that register stock market activity. So that could have a lot to do with the Dow getting to 100,000 if the Dow still exists 50 years from now. But generally, I don't see any problems with inflation. I see mostly a neutral to sideways, maybe even a slightly deflationary period for the next 4 to 5 years. And then after that, it start to pick up and go on for, you know, maybe as much as 10 to 20 years.
Glenn, is there anything that would throw some of these forecasts off kilter somewhat? Let's say, for example, if the world's oil production peaks in the next 2 or 3 years, as many geologists see, I mean, how would that change some of your forecast?
Well, wave theory is sort of on each market is independent of everything else. In other words, whatever the wave structure implies for one particular market is independent of other circumstances, because what everyone thinks about a market is the collection of all the wisdom of the masses put into one particular price at a particular point in time, and the collection of all those prices together creates a reflection of what the psychology is and what the expectations are and so forth. So I can't speak about what external events might happen to change my mind. I can only speak about what price events would happen to change my wave count, which would then change my mind. So if for some reason the S&P were able to break the March low of 2003, which is around 800, 775 in the cash S&P, if that low were to be broken any time in the next 5 years, it would cause serious problems with what I currently think is going on and would possibly force me to turn more bearish. But as long as we stay above that level, I see no reason to be concerned.
Glenn, as we close, if there was one message that you would give to investors right now, what would that be?
Well, a lot of people have found my Dow prediction of 100,000 or more in the next, by mid-century, sort of, unbelievable, absurd, ridiculous. Whatever they think about it now, just imagine what it was like when the Dow was at 1900. But as it stands right now, we're talking about Dow move to about 100,000, or at least that's what I'm predicting, in about 45 years or so. And if you look at the historical record, the Dow had gone from a low of about 0.3 in 1765 up to about 2700 in 1987, which is an increase of about 1,000,000% in a little over 200 years. So to go from 2700, which is the 87 high, up to 100,000 is only 4,900% increase, which sounds like a lot, but compared to 1,000,000%, it's pretty small. And I'm allowing 70 years for that to take place, at least 70 years from when I originally wrote that article. So now I guess we have about 45 more years to go. And now, of course, we're at about 11,000. So we've gone a long way toward reaching that goal. So I think the most important thing to understand is that markets progress on a logarithmic percentage basis, not on a numerical basis or an arithmetic basis, so that to get to 100,000 isn't quite as difficult as it sounds. If you just double the Dow's current level, that's about 3 or 4 times, you're at 100,000. So it's not that unattainable. It's just going to take time. And obviously, to achieve those levels, we're going to have a lot of increases in efficiency in the way our society runs, the way the government runs. And all those things are, I think, underway, but they will take quite a bit of time to unfold. So that's my point. Primarily, just it's not as difficult to believe once you understand that it just requires the Dow doubling about 3.5 times from its current level over the next 50 years.
Well, Glenn, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about your services and your website?
Well, the website is neowave.com. That's N-E-O-W-A-V-E, neowave.com. Obviously, I have an 800 number. That's 800-NEOWAVE. And the services that we provide are based mostly on the S&P, gold, and T-notes. And we have trading services, which are mostly just the goal is to make money with those services. And then we have chart services, which are more educational for those who want to learn wave theory in my more advanced form that I call neo-wave theory. We also have training classes, and we just recently started some money management projects, too, where people can let us do the trading for them the way that we're doing it in our newsletter if they are not, able to follow that sort of thing. So we have multiple different ways that people can take advantage of our services, lots of different types of information that we provide.
All right. Well, Glenn, on behalf of Ike Iosef and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us this month on Ahead of the Trends. Wish you all the best, sir.
Okay, Jim. Appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Well, Ike, that was rather interesting. When you told me that Glenn was from an Elliott Wave perspective, the first thing I was thinking, oh, no, another deflationist, because I'm glad to hear that he's not in the deflationary camp, because I think the deflationists have been wrong for almost 2 decades now. But two things that you could almost see from a perspective of imperial ambitions, if you see things like the European nations coming together with the euro, Japan is talking about Asian nations coming together with their own currency, and then, of course, with the North American or with NAFTA, you could see almost these consolidated trading blocks around the globe. So there's some truth to that. The one thing that I find disturbing, though, is what is going on in China and Russia today, and especially Russia with Putin, who has spent consolidating his power and is now acting more like a czar than he is, let's say, president of a nation. And Russia's rebuilding its military, particularly its nuclear forces, and the same thing is going on with China. All of this occurring at a time that the world may be heading into peak oil. These are some disturbing trends, although he did say that the next 10 years could be rough. I could see a very rough time here in the next 10 years.
I happen to believe that both Russia and China are strategic competitors. And I don't believe that the U.S. will ever have with either of these two nations the kind of relationship that we have with Canada or with Europe or even with Japan. And I also believe that oil, with its strategic importance, will be a point of contention among the three of us. Of course, Russia has quite a bit of it on its own, nevertheless, controlling oil has a lot to do with how the economy performs worldwide. And I think that's something that both Russia and China would have to have a word on.
Well, the one comment that he said, which is very interesting, is that we're going to go away from growth, more of a consolidation, more of grabbing imperialistic ambitions. And the same thing occurs with companies, that when an industry matures from its growth phase, then the only way it can grow is through acquisitions or by taking market share from somebody else. So you can see a very similar political pattern in terms of what he's saying there. The only difference, I think, this time is you've got some very powerful nations that are getting nuclear weapons, Russia, China, and the proliferation of those weapons. It's a different kind of world. And when everybody is arming in the way that we're doing now, it reminds me of what nations did prior to going into World War I. So I think the combination of oil, the combination of a lot of bank credit, the Fed, which I believe will start another mania again, because the next soft patch that we're going to, as the economy rolls over, I could see the Fed actually accelerating money and credit. But the only difference this time is they can't control where it goes. So we'll have another bubble develop somewhere, which I think is going to be in natural resources, which are in short supply.
I feel the same way. I think the rally that we saw right now in natural resources stocks is only the beginning. I think we're going to see something that will make 19 the rallies that we had going up to 1980, 1982 pale.
Well, I absolutely agree. I think, as somebody said, we live in interesting times. I'm just not sure how much interesting I want them to be, but it looks like that's where we're going. Well, on behalf of Ike Iosef and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us on this month's Ahead of the Trends. We'd like to welcome you back next month when we'll have certainly interesting conversations. I imagine this month's guest was not what you're used to hearing.